Today we're going to begin a new study. We're going to begin a study on Jesus. We're going to approach it in a slightly different way. No person has ever made a greater impact on the world than Jesus. That can be demonstrated in all sorts of ways. The number of people who claim to be followers of Him, the largest single religious group in the world, is the Christian religion. And even the second largest religion of the world, while not claiming Jesus as being their leader, acknowledges Him as a prophet of God. That's the Muslim or Islamic religion. More books have been written about Him than any other person who's ever lived. More paintings, more sculptures, more artistic expressions of people's feelings about Him exist of Jesus than any other, and I would even dare say any other two people put together that have ever existed, ever lived in the history of our world. Numerous examples could be given of His influence in subtle kind of ways. A famous British novelist, we might remember him best, H.G. Wells, for a story he wrote that was later broadcast as a radio play that had a profound effect on people called The War of the Worlds. But H.G. Wells, who was a novelist, was also a historian and wrote a 5-volume set of books on the history of the world. And in that, the largest single section talking about any one person in that entire 5-volume set is a section on Jesus. Greater than the influence that Winston Churchill, well, he wouldn't have written about Winston Churchill because he lived before him, but greater than the influence of George Washington, of Julius Caesar, of Nebuchadnezzar, of any historical figure, the section that deals with the time and life of Jesus is by far the largest. And what's so fascinating about that is that H.G. Wells was at least an agnostic and a skeptic, and many believe actually an atheist. And yet he acknowledged the influence that Jesus had on the world. Even those who are rabid, vociferous haters of religion in general, and perhaps even of Christianity specifically, find it difficult to find anything bad to say about Jesus. About the most they can do is imply that most of what we as Christians believe about Him is either incorrect or not founded on fact. And yet they can't say much of anything in a negative way about Jesus Himself. And yet, in all of this influences He's had, all this historical record, all of these people who believe in Him, all these reproductions of Him in art, of all the various kinds and so forth, in spite of all of that, we do not know what He looked like. Now, I've chosen to put into our bulletin for today a page of images taken from various sources concerning Him. And if one thing stands out in all these images, it is this. People have chosen to make Jesus look like someone they are comfortable with. Because in fact, we don't know what He looked like. If you were to pull that out of your bulletin and look, the very first picture is a very common picture when I was growing up. I remember going in many homes, even my grandmother's home, and seeing this picture hanging on the wall. I don't even know who the artist is, so I could probably discover it. I'm not going to try to go through all these pictures. The second picture is a statue by Michelangelo. It looks very different than the one right next to it, doesn't it? On either side. Michelangelo, the great sculptor and artist of the 1500s. On the second row of pictures, the leftmost picture, the little line drawing there comes from the illustrations that were in the Good News Bible translation and were produced by a lady named Annie Volotin, a famous artist who was able, with just the simplicity of pen strokes, create very profound pictures that communicate. The picture in the middle on the second row is a picture from a famous artist in Jamaica. Is it interesting that probably Jesus looks a lot like the people He knows? The picture that's in the circle is one of the earliest pictures we have of what people thought Jesus looked like. It dates back to around the AD 250s or 300s, and it comes from a wall painting in the catacombs beneath the great city of Rome. That's also true of the middle picture that's in the third row of pictures that shows very lightly sketched out there. Actually, it was originally a painting on the walls above a tomb in the catacombs of Jesus and his apostles, he being in the middle in the largest image there. Picture on the left in the third row is a Japanese or Korean picture in one of their storybooks of what Jesus looked like. He looked like them. He looked like their great heroes of old. The picture on the third row on the right-hand side, Jim spotted it right away, is the image that has been produced by those who are studying the Shroud of Turin. And they say this is the image that has come up on that shroud as they've examined it. The bottom row on the left is a picture from about the 600s produced by the Orthodox Church. The second picture on the bottom row is out of a popular modern children's storybook about Bible stories. The third picture is a picture that was produced by the National Geographic and a special they put on in 2010 on television, in which they hired an artist to try to draw a picture of what he thought Jesus might have looked like. And of course, the last picture on the bottom of the page is one of many different actors who have played Jesus in movies over the last 100 years. Which one of these is the real Jesus? In a sense, all of them are. But in another very profound way, none of them are. Because even though Jesus has been painted innumerable times by artists for over 1,500 years, his picture appears in almost every children's storybook about the Bible. Many have pictures of him displayed in their homes or in their family Bibles or in other places. We have them in our children's classrooms at church, and he's often shown as the Good Shepherd or knocking at the door or sitting at the Last Supper or hanging on the cross. Yet not one of these images or portraits is based on any solid evidence as to what Jesus actually looked like. Was he short or tall? Handsome or plain? Dark or fair? Blue eyes or brown? Long hair or short? Bearded or clean-shaven? Muscular or stout? Or even slight of build? All the eyewitness records we have concerning Jesus are those that are found in our New Testament. And there is not one clear answer to any of these questions about how Jesus looked. Certainly on one hand, it would have been to their advantage to have described Jesus, because perhaps to others in their day, it would have served as additional evidence that they were true eyewitnesses of him. And yet they didn't do that. Some have reasoned, and perhaps correctly so, that based on various kinds of research about what we do know about people who lived at the time Jesus lived and the part of the world where he lived, that we might surmise that he had a beard or not, that he might have had dark hair and dark eyes or not, that he might have only been about 5'5" tall or not. And yet none of those actually fit the criteria of evidence. You know, I'm always amazed when they come out with these things, even about our American culture, when they say the average American man is, 5'11.5" tall and weighs about 205 pounds. And then I look around, I see all sorts of people who don't fit that. That's just the average. And so even when an anthropologist and historians tell us that the average person in Jesus' time living in that part of the world was about this big and looked about like this, that's only the average. That doesn't tell us about any one particular person, and especially not about Jesus. Now, yes, there are a couple of references in the Old Testament, and we've heard them, that talk about how in one place in a prophecy it talks about how they will pluck his beard out. And in another, in Isaiah 53, it will talk about that he did not look desirable. He did not He was not such that when we looked on him that we desired him. And so some have presumed from that that he was probably a very ordinary looking person. Again, I think all those are reasonable assumptions, but they don't rise up to the level of actual evidence of what he looked like. It's not like people in Jesus' time were not capable of describing what he looked like. The truth is, there are several current historical records from that time that still exist of other people in which they're described in great detail as to their height and their color of their eyes and the color of their hair and all sorts of things about them. So we know people not only were capable of doing that, but that it was often done in biographical type materials from the first century, but not about Jesus. Numerous statues still exist of at least some of the more prominent Roman and Greek men, and in some cases even women who lived during that period of time. And we could look at them and we can know pretty much what they looked like. But no such statues exist of Jesus. Why? Just like the answer to what Jesus looked like is, we don't know. The answer to the question of why, our eyewitnesses do not ever give us even so much as a mention of his beard or his height or anything else. We also don't have the answer to why they don't do that. They knew who he was, the greatest person they'd ever known. And yet all the emphasis in what they write is not about what he looked like, not even so much as a mention, but rather upon who he was, what he was, why he came to this earth and walked it, his words and his nature and his character. It's granted at the very beginning of their writings that he was a man, just like us, using man generically. And so he was like all others in that regard. But what they wanted everyone to know is not how he was like us, but how he was different than us and totally unique in what really counted. I spoke a couple of Sunday nights ago and two consecutive weeks on the leader of the Apple computer company, and that was during a time when he had just passed away and all sorts of tributes were being poured out. He was all over the news and everything, Steve Jobs. And certainly he made a profound impact on technology and the way people use technology, the everything from the cell phones we carry to the computers we use to all sorts of other things. And then this past week, his authorized biography, the only one that he ever allowed anyone to officially write about him and he participated in, was released. And some people were shocked. Not because of the pictures of him in there. There's lots of pictures in the book. People didn't buy the book to know what he looked like. They bought the book so they would know what he was like. And there's a difference, isn't there? They discover in this book that was based upon not only interviews with many, many people and examination of the evidence by the author, but also based upon over 40 different interviews that the author had with Steve Jobs himself while he was alive. This book has been put together. And in Steve Jobs' own words, you discover that while he was a great man, in a lot of ways, he was not a very good man. He was very, very difficult to live with. He did not always treat other people the way we would think that he ought to treat them. He was driven oftentimes by desire to create things rather than how what he did to people caused them to feel. He was pretty insensitive in many ways, especially in his workplace with those like that. And yet on the other hand, you discover he had a wife and he had children and they loved him dearly and he always made sure almost without fail to be home for dinner and to spend the evenings with them unless he had the most important thing to do. He was home every night with his family. Very complex person in some ways. But we're reading all that and we don't have to know what he looked like to end up knowing something about what Steve Jobs was like. The same is true of Jesus. So we're going to begin this series that I'm calling Portraits of Jesus. And we're not going to be looking at the pictures like is in your bulletin. But instead, we're going to be looking at the pictures that the eyewitnesses painted of him. Not pictures of what he looked like, but pictures of what he was like. For those are the most important kind. And we can know Jesus based on that. Our scripture for this morning was read at the beginning is a reflection of that when Peter, who was an eyewitness of Jesus, and is one of the ones we will be relying on to tell us what Jesus was like, when he writes his letter in 1 Peter to Christians who were scattered off in other parts of the Roman Empire, he's writing to people who were devoted believers in Jesus, and in the coming months and years, many of them were going to end up giving their lives for their faith in Jesus. And yet Peter knew that they had never even seen Jesus in person. And so he begins his letter that way by saying in 1 Peter chapter 1, he's talking to them about how they rejoice. 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, even though they are suffering all kinds of trials. And then in verse 7, he says, these trials have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. He's saying their faith is being tested by these trials that they're about to endure and have already started to endure. And it's going to end up proving that their faith is real, is genuine, that even though they're going to pass through the fire, they will not have their faith destroyed. And he says then his most key thing in verse 8, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Peter says, you believe in somebody you have never seen. And you are now willing to die for someone you don't even see now. And you're willing to die for your faith for something you haven't yet seen either. The salvation of your souls and an eternal presence with Christ when He comes. So you see, it is possible for people to believe in someone and to live for someone and even to die for someone who they've never seen. Paul, when he was writing to the Galatians, was very upset with them because after they had come to believe in Jesus and had started living out their faith, some false teachers had come in among them and was telling them that faith in Jesus was not enough, that they needed to go off and do these other things. They had to go back and start keeping the law of Moses and keep the Sabbath days and keep the holy days and be circumcised and all of that. Which is the very thing Jesus came to take people away from. And so as he writes to them, we just pull out this one verse in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1. He says, you foolish Galatians. Now you can only say that because of the deep personal relationship he had with them. And he knew that they would take that in the right kind of way. It would shake them up without causing them to be alienated from him because of his words. But he says, you foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Before your very eyes, Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed as crucified. Paul says, when I and others came among you and first preached the gospel, we described to you the crucifixion of Jesus and all that it meant in such a way it was as if a picture was painted for you. His crucifixion was portrayed before your very eyes. And yet they had never seen him either. One more passage like that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul spent a long time in the city of Corinth, and he visited there several other times besides the time when he was there for over 2 years. And so he had a deep relationship with these Christians here. And the church there had many problems. And his two letters to them are written to try to correct some of those problems. But one thing he always wanted them to do is to remain true to what they had heard him teach them. And not just him, others had come along with him and taught them. And so he writes to them in his first letter in chapter 2. He says in verse 1, "When I came to your brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God." Realize that Corinth was a part of ancient Greece. And Greece in New Testament times and for a long time before that was considered the center of knowledge and wisdom in the ancient world. The only other place in the ancient world that perhaps tried to rival them at times would be way off to the east in what was left by that time of the ancient Medo-Persian Empire, where they had their wise men as well, and from which, of course, the three, as we call them, wise men came to see the infant Jesus that's recorded in the birth narrative about Jesus. They came from over there. But Paul is writing to these Corinthians because they had grown up and lived all their life in this culture in which they treasured greatly wise men and knowledge and those who could speak eloquently about those things. And they had these great philosophers in their past, the Platos and the Socrates and all the others like that. And yet Paul says, "When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom, as I proclaim to you the testimony about God, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." Paul says, "My entire message was not one designed to impress you by my knowledge or wisdom or eloquence. Instead, it was to inform you and to bring you to faith in Jesus Christ and Him crucified." So we're going to look at some portraits of Jesus in the Scriptures. We're going to see the picture of Him before He ever came to earth. So that in fact, when we first see the child in Bethlehem, He is actually a visitor from somewhere else who's now come to earth. We're going to see how it was possible that He could be, on the one hand, flesh and blood like we are, a human being, and at the same time, God. Deity joined together with humanity. We're going to see the picture of Him growing up Jewish. We're going to see the picture of Him as a miracle worker, as a master teacher, as the Son of God. We're going to see the picture of Him in His human relationships as a son and a brother and a friend and a teacher. We're going to see the picture of Him as it developed in those who lived with Him as becoming their Lord and Master. We're going to see Him as a rebel and an outcast. We're going to see the portrait of Him rejected and crucified. We're going to see the picture of Him, borrowing from a famous movie of a few years ago, we're going to see the picture of Him as a dead man walking. But it's just the reverse of what that movie was about. If you know what that movie was about, it was about a man who was on death row and condemned to die. With Jesus, it's just the opposite. He was a man who had already been condemned and had died, and now is walking the earth again. We're going to see the picture of Him sitting at God's right hand today as King. And we're going to see the picture of Him coming to judge the world. And then we're going to see the picture of Him in His role in all eternity to come. When we open up the pages of our New Testament, among other things, we are stepping into God's portrait gallery of His beloved Son. And every picture is of Him. And every picture needs to be studied and examined by us, so that we will not so much know what He looked like as we will know what He was like. And so that even though we haven't seen Him, we love Him. And even though we don't see Him now, we believe in Him and have an inexpressible joy about what the future holds for us in our relationship with Him.